Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Paul Dawson, he's a professor at Clemson University, and Brian Sheldon, a professor emeritus in food microbiology at North Carolina State University. And we're here talking about their new book, Did You Just Eat That? Two scientists explore double dipping, the 5-second rule, and other food myths in the lab.
All right.
Paul, Brian, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Glad to be able to converse with you guys.
Although you're on a hotel phone, and I'm immediately concerned about what you're touching. This book is one of my favorite science books of this year. It is written for the general public, yet it doesn't water down the hard science. And it's vastly entertaining and important. Talk to me about how you came to write this book.
Well, this is Paul. We did several studies with our students on these topics related to, as you mentioned, everyday habits and practices. And initially it was for them to learn how to do research, but we, in the process, wanted to publish those, and we did. And one thing led to another. They got some interest because some of the media picked it up and wrote articles about it. And based on that interest, we decided to compile 10 of those into with a book with a nice introduction about microbiology, as you mentioned.
Oh, it's great.
And kind of some food safety tips at the end to hopefully prevent, minimize chances of getting sick.
I want to mention, this is a hard science book too. And you have a section in every single chapter about, you know, the sort of what kind of experiments you did, materials and methods and science, science stuff ahead. It must have been important for you to include the hard science for this.
Well, this is Brian, and it definitely was. We're both are scientists and have been involved in research for many years. And most of our publications are in scientific journals, and working with these students, obviously we wanted to introduce them to this whole process, not only just doing the research, but that was a key, but obviously teaching them the materials and methods that we need to use in order to validate, you know, the hypothesis that had been established. And without that, we felt that we were denying, you know, our readers actually how we did these things, and to, you know, kind of validate and verify, you know, that the research that we did is, you know, solid and follows strict scientific principles.
You need to remind the public, and on this interview, how important the impact is of foodborne diseases. A lot of people are afflicted every year. As a matter of fact, probably more than we know. Because I dare say a lot of people, including myself, if I just get a real bad bout of diarrhea or some kind of intestinal problem, I don't go to the doctor and I don't report it.
Right. The CDC has numbers and their estimates based on the numbers they get. But also, as you mentioned, some people don't go to the doctor and report. So the estimates are 1 in 6 Americans each year get foodborne illness. That's 17%. Estimated about 3,000 deaths, which is very serious, and then their numbers are currently, in the last few years, $77 billion at the cost from doctors' bills and missed work to individuals who get foodborne illness. And the effects go much wider or deeper than that. It doesn't account for recalls from food companies. We're currently under some romaine lettuce issues.
Oh, yeah.
There's already cycling through. There'll be another one probably in the next month, a different one, but doesn't account for that. Lost businesses. Companies go out of business because of bad public response to these issues and so forth. So it is a big problem. And one thing we don't really hear about, and we don't necessarily highlight in the book, is there are also, like you said, many of us have a stomach bug for a few days and probably know we got it from eating something, but there are some long-term effects in some cases. People have reactive arthritis from salmonella infections that last a lifetime in some cases, and many others, paralysis from campylobacter infections. So it's a widespread issue and one we don't take lightly.
I might add just sentence or two to that. Actually, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, actually estimate there's like 48 million cases a year. And a vast number of them don't go reported for some of the reasons that you mentioned, because we commonly don't associate with the food that we've eaten, and you get over it within a few days. And it's only those that obviously people make it to the hospital and the unfortunate ones that succumb to it make the headlines, and of course are report to the CDC. So, but a vast number of them don't ever actually make it to the CDC.
Now, and Mark, if I might add one more thing,
yeah,
kind of running on here, but another interesting fact I think people may not know, that we hear about Salmonella, E. coli, and others in the news, but in fact about 80% of the foodborne illnesses are not from unknown sources, are foodborne, or food sickness. So that's kind of another thing, and over half hospitalizations and half the deaths are from unknown sources. So there's a lot out there to be concerned about, as well as not known.
Now,
and related to that, if I could,
sure.
Just one additional point, and that a vast majority, I would say over 60% of these outbreaks are associated with eating out. And
yes.
And the American public, I think the guesstimation is about 40% of us Americans eat out daily.
Right.
So, again, that increased the risk, the odds that, you know, some point, you know, that one out of six, that we're going to come down with something on an annual basis at least once.
Now, as we're talking about this, and I want, it's important for the public to realize this, this is the most entertaining science book I've ever read. Graphically, the way that you approach this problem in dealing with the food myths like the 5-second rule or double dipping, and we'll talk about stuff in a bit. I want to talk about the design of this book. The design of this book is brilliant because we're dealing with a deathly serious subject, yet you made it incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, that was. I'm glad to hear you say that. That's your take, because that was the objective. Our idea was, we started, had Rich with graphics to, you know, throw in trivia. Because we are, you can tell by the name of the book, we are, while it's a serious topic, we are kind of taking very simple practices, or if you will, myths, and kind of putting science to them. And while these aren't your major maybe foodborne illness sources, they are dealing with a topic that's very serious. So we try to blend that fun approach with some science and get the point across.
I have never read a science book like this, because it is deep science, but really fun, yet very serious at the same time. You also have an entire introduction to the microbial world. And I have to say, I think when people think of wildlife or the natural world on planet Earth, I think most people are totally ignorant about how the microbial world works.
Well, that's basically why we titled that first chapter, you know, the mysterious microbial world. Mysterious is that, you know, we don't see them. And that we see the after effects of them, either through food spoiling or getting sick. And in fact, you know, they grow at very rapid populations or growth rates, and they reach extremely high populations. As you've seen and read through some of the statistics and
yeah.
facts that we put in there, you know, there's more bacteria on our skin or in our GI tracts than we have cells in our own body, like 39 trillion versus
Jesus.
30 trillion cells, human cells. So it's a vast population of organisms that account in this whole world, and that we really don't know a lot about them other than what they do to us. And there, of course, there's a lot of benefits to the microorganisms.
Right, right.
We feel that 99% of them actually have seemingly no adverse or even beneficial effects upon us, you know, aiding in our digestion. Of course, a lot of different foods are made as a result, food and drink, you know, your beer and your
That's
wine
right.
and your cheese and your yogurts and fermented meats, etc. And, of course, we get drugs from them. And, of course, the big thing that we're seeing these days is that we really think that it has a very positive impact upon our own bodies. And we're just trying to learn a lot more about what that impact is. And, it's, you know, they're just not neutral organisms in our GI tract. They are a living organism that's taking, you know, taking up and metabolizing the food that we provide them, you know, the food that we actually are eating. And of course, they're producing end products. They help in improving your immunity and obviously help, many of the readers, including myself, take probiotics.
That's right.
These are, you know, living organisms that we hope, and what the theory is that they will knock out and overpopulate our GI tract and knock out the bad players, so to speak.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Paul Dawson, professor at Clemson University, Brian Sheldon, professor emeritus in food microbiology at North Carolina State University. And we're talking about, I think, one of the best science books this year. Did you just eat that? The two scientists explore double dipping, the 5-second rule, and other food myths in the lab. Let's give an example. And I can't believe you guys did this, because this really struck a chord with me. You covered beer pong. And for people who don't know, you know, I'm old enough. I'm so old that I came before beer pong. I think beer pong came in after me. But explain what beer pong is before we talk about the experiments.
Yeah, some of the fun parts of the book were topics like that. But also we actually did background research and kind of learned ourselves. Beer pong apparently was initiated by Lehigh and Bucknell.
I can't believe you found that out.
And I think 50s or 60s, and they called it. They actually at the time I think initially used paddles, and
that's right.
They called it. The term was called Beirut. You know, we both live in college towns or near college towns, and you know, during football season, you go through the grocery store, and for sale are ping pong balls and Solo cups. Actually packaged right next to each other, so pretty much know what's going on there. The gist of the game is you get on a table, like a ping pong table or a smaller table, usually two people on each end, and they each have a cup half full of beer. You take turns from one end throwing the ping pong ball, trying to land in your other team's cup. If you're successful, they have to drink the beer that's in the cup, and then they get their turn. Of course,
okay, let's stop there.
People aren't very good shots, and it bounces around the room.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was a study, and actually in our study it was a lot of fun.
It's serious. I mean, I don't think people who, especially if you're playing beer pong as you're listening to this, you're probably not thinking about this. You designed two experiments, and these are serious experiments. 2.1 was, first of all, to see if bacteria could be found on ping pong balls. How did you do that?
We went out on a homecoming weekend. Our students went out with fresh, clean ping pong balls and exchanged them for ping pong balls that were being used in games around the town, if you will. I won't say campus. I'll say around the town. They brought them, put them in a sterile bag, brought them back to the lab. And this is a kind of a survey, and much of our studies have this two-phase, as you mentioned. Go out and survey a topic and see if there is an issue or what's out there. And you might guess in most cases there are going to be extremes, maximums and minimums,
right,
variation. And in fact, one thing we did, we accounted for where the games were being played, from outdoors to indoors on carpet, hardwood and so forth. And again, took them back to the lab and found that outdoor games, you might expect because there are balls landing on the outdoors, a little more bacteria out there, had highest amounts, whereas carpeted games were lowest. But again, we found one ball that had 3 million bacteria on it.
Jeez. So, now, you know, let me say something about carpeting, because when I read that in the book, that seemed counterintuitive, because whenever I think of a carpet, like in a frat house or something like that, to me that seems like a nest of bacteria. But you're saying that of the indoor surfaces, that was the least, had the least amount.
Well, yeah, you're probably right, and that kind of relates to our 5-second rule. There's probably carpet's probably going to be, I would guess, a better home, if you will, for bacteria, because it's, you can get down in the threads and all.
Right.
But the ball lands on the top of the carpet, much like we are in the 5-second rule. The food lands on top of the carpet, and there's less surface area, I guess, in contact with the bacteria, if you will, that is now embedded in the carpet. But that carpet's probably, because it's just a better environment. Moist stays moist and whatnot.
Right.
If you spill something on there, like a sugared drink, it's going to be food for the bacteria. So you're probably right.
But is it that the ball rests on the surface of the fibers, and therefore doesn't? doesn't get down in.
That's our guess. I wouldn't say the carpet's cleaner.
Yeah, my wild guess is that if you're playing beer pong, that carpet is not going to be very clean whatsoever.
And we actually did some presumptive identification. We found categories of bacteria from those we recovered from those random beer pong games.
Yeah.
We found staph. Like staph that could be staph, could be E. coli, could be salmonella. Again, we didn't take it down. It takes a lot of expensive and time-consuming work to get the exact species and genus and strain. But in other words, there were those out there. And I think another thing is the one I would have most concern with would be the staph, because really probably people handling the ball where you're going to have the biggest concern, because that's people transferring bacteria, staph. There are staph strains that are pathogens. So, not only that,
as the beer pong game proceeds, you're getting less and less concerned about the cleanliness of the ball.
Yeah, Brian, we have a scenario there. We always tell you want to,
yeah. Basically, the one scenario, as you say, you drink more beer. Obviously, you get a little more inebriated, and of course that leads to having to relieve yourself, and I suspect that there's not a lot of hand washing that occurs after you've relieved yourself. So again, that adds to the potential contamination. It could be those things you pick up on the ground and on carpeting, et cetera, but also what's on your hands that have touched other parts of your body.
I love you guys. You guys are great. Now, that's only the first experiment because there is bacteria on the ping pong ball. But the next question, and this is how science works, you had to ask the question, can bacteria travel from the ping pong ball to the beer that it's landing in?
Yeah, that was the beauty, I think, of our studies and dealing with students. They're very simple design, but again, like you mentioned, doing a scientific method. So yeah, we had not. So first step, we went out and found it was there. So now we go in the lab, a controlled study, where we're inoculating the ping pong ball with a known amount of bacteria. In fact, we're knocking what we call a labeled bacterium. E. coli we had was a fluorescent gene in embedded in it. So when we counted them, we only counted the fluorescing bacteria on our plates. So we knew that the bacteria that we're counting in the beer had to come from the ping pong ball. So there was no, cross contamination didn't want to count. So essentially, and again, these are not surprising. If you throw something, it's contaminated into a fluid, it's going to transfer. But I guess we did the numbers and did the statistics and replications and found that over 100,000. Bacteria were found in the beer, transferred the beer from the ping pong ball, which were about, a little less than tenfold. So nearly 90% of the bacteria that were on the ball, were transferred.
As you mentioned before, there's a lot of other things you discovered while you're making this book, and something I never knew at all. There was something called Pong Flu that showed up at these tournaments, and people had a name for it, but it sounded like they didn't know what it was.
Yeah, and that's the other interesting. We talked about the origin, and then now it kind of has regained popularity. And now there's a world pong championship. There's state leagues. There's a lot in Europe and UK and Ireland. There's these pong, and that's a world pong championship. I think it's last I looked, it was $50,000 first prize. But yeah, the organizer of that said there's what he called the pong flu, and he kind of made a comment that he wasn't sure whether it was from getting sick or actually drinking too much, but maybe a combination of that.
Now, we're probably going to have time to only talk about one more. And the one I want to talk about, I think, was the one that unnerved me the most because I never thought of it before. Of course, it makes total sense once I read about it in your book, and that's menus. I don't think most of us even give a second thought to picking up a menu and perusing it when we go into a restaurant. And you bring up the very important point. Obviously, they've been handled a lot, and you designed a series of experiments to see what's on a menu and can it be transferred to your hands.
Yeah, yes, we did. And, of course, as Paul indicated, all these studies usually start with a survey of sorts, and In this case, we went out to the community, a different restaurant types, be it pizza, steakhouses, bars, Mexican restaurants, etc., and to establish if these menus were in fact contaminated. And our students, they only sampled a very small portion, a 6-inch portion of those menus, and of course brought them back to the lab. And we found, as you can imagine, fairly significant populations on those menus. And again, we're only sampling a portion of the menu, ranging from about 6,000 to 12,000 organisms, depending upon the site of where we got the menus from. And of course, it was, you know, a limited sampling. You only have so many restaurants that you can sample in our particular community. And so, it's hard to draw conclusions about one restaurant type over another, but you know, we did have larger numbers, higher populations were found in the Mexican restaurant and even the upscale restaurant.
That's what was surprising to me when I read about the upscale restaurant. Do you have any theory about why upscale restaurants would have more bacteria?
I'll let Paul answer.
Yeah, well, like as Brian said, it's a limited sample, so it could have been the luck of the draw.
Want to hear my theory about it?
I had a theory. Yeah, go ahead.
My theory is that when you have upscale restaurants, you have these big menus that are bound, and they probably never change them. Whereas when you have a regular restaurant, they may have a paper menu or a laminated paper menu that they change a lot. And I just wonder if the upscale restaurants don't change their menus that much, therefore the stuff builds up.
Right, or if it's some of those places that are upscale have like a little folder, they actually slide the menu in.
Yep.
They're actually touching the plastic cover every time. They may not. And I was thinking, man, that's just not a priority. They think they're generally upscale, so they don't feel a need to clean. You know, that's not something you clean. The tables are clean, utensils are clean, everything's clean, but menus really may not be on the high priority list or thought of to need to be cleaned, especially like if it's some of those really nice ones that are folded and so forth. So
like books.
That's a good point.
But then the second part of the experiment, again, that's just the first part. Can you then pick up those bacteria by handling it?
Of course, I suspect, based upon what we've already told you, that you can. And we ran, a controlled study where we inoculated the menu that we had actually made up ourselves, laminated a menu, and inoculated with one of our test strains, and then had our participants handle the menu for 1 minute, after which time we cultured what organism we cut off their hands. And as you can imagine, they picked up a significant population of those test bacterial strains on their hands within that 1 minute period of time. We were able to demonstrate that if that menu is contaminated, it will contaminate your hands. And the same thing goes the other way around, too. If you have contaminated hands that are touching the menu, if it's clean or not clean, they are transferring organisms from our hands onto those menus.
Did it make any difference if they were laminated or paper?
We use laminated. There's other studies, and I guess another point in the book, we actually don't just use, we talk about other studies and bring them in as much as we could find, and actually found, I believe, that the paper menus were a little better. You know, you wouldn't think that because they get stained, but surprisingly, bacteria survive pretty well in plastic. We use laminated plastic in that study that Brian just described, but we didn't test paper menus, so I can't make a definitive statement about that.
Because it is kind of counterintuitive. One would expect the paper to be more contaminated because, one, it's very difficult to clean a paper menu.
Right.
And that may be another reason that the upscale restaurant, the best thing they can do is throw it away, and the cost of, you know, making up menus might limit them and how often they throw it away.
Well, and the other thing is, if they're cleaning off the menu, what are they cleaning it off with? Like a wet rag that they're cleaning the tables off with, and then they're wiping the laminated menus off. So yeah, it gets rid of the spaghetti stains, but it's not getting rid of the bacteria.
Yeah, they should be using some sort of sanitizer, especially on the laminate. They're very limited what they could do with paper. menus.
Now, there's so many questions. We're almost out of time. And I just want to mention one of my favorites that I thought about, but I never knew the facts of, was blowing birthday candles out. What a disaster that turns out to be. I've been telling everybody after reading this book, I've been telling everybody, don't do the birthday candle thing. It's like, and I love the fact that you designed a cake that you could actually monitor for bacteria.
Yeah, we did some thinking about that because, you know, if you have a whole cake and you try to analyze the logistics of trying to analyze the whole cake when you're only really probably concerned about the top where people are blowing candles out was problematic in the lab. So we, as you mentioned, designed, we really were interested in the left top layer with where the icing was. So that's what we focused on. We, as you mentioned in the book, we kind of have a picture of it where we have
neat.
A piece of sterile styrofoam as a base, but the sterile foil and then a layer of icing on that. And then actually we wanted to simulate the real action best we could, so we actually put candles through the icing into the styrofoam, so I used styrofoam because so they would stick and hold, and then lit the candles and actually had them blow them out and then pull the candles out and analyze what was left. And what's nice in these studies, and students learned, is we would repeat the exact same process with another mock cake, and the only difference was we did not blow the candles out. We put the candles in, we lit them, then took them out. So we're comparing one that's been blown on, treated exactly the same as one that had not been blown on. So the only difference in those two was one had been blown on. So that the difference in numbers you see in the results are strictly due to the blowing of candles out.
And for people who don't understand science, this is what it is, designing experiments like this. And that's one of the real pleasures of this book. And one of the most important, I think, things that I learned in the book is the proper way to clean your hands. We're completely out of time, so people are going to have to pick up the book in order to see that. But you have that very well elaborated in this book. My guest tonight, Paul Dawson, professor at Clemson University, Brian Sheldon, professor emeritus in food microbiology at North Carolina State University. Together, they've written a great science book, an entertaining science book, and a serious science book all rolled into one. Did you just eat that? Two scientists explore double dipping, the 5-second rule, and other food myths in the lab. Paul and Brian, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks a lot. We enjoyed it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Uncle Mark. Good night.